William Gibson says that to read Mark Lehner's The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack is to have it etched on your brain with a sharp periodontal tool. Publishers Weekly says it may indeed be the craziest book ever written. So what is this mind-bending, hallucinatory vortex of a novel all about? Who better to tell us than the author of The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack himself, Mark Lehner?
There is a man. He's an unemployed butcher. His name is Ike Carton. He lives in Jersey City, New Jersey. And Ike believes, rightly or wrongly, I don't want to have to issue a spoiler alert here, but Ike believes that there is a pantheon of gods that determine what happens to mortals. There's some question raised in the book about whether these gods only exist in Ike's mind. There's also a kind of metaphysical proof, a kind of very logical proof posited by someone that the fact that they may exist only in Ike's mind proves their existence. So there are all kinds of conversations about that. But really, in terms of what happens in the book, Ike goes to a diner and gets a tongue sandwich and flirts with the waitress, comes back, and then hangs out with his daughter's boyfriend, whose name is Vance, and basically waits to be killed. Ike has a kind of, I shouldn't say a fear, in a way it's a hope, because Ike thinks that it's his destiny to be killed in front of his family and his neighbors, killed by Mossad, sharpshooters. The great passion of Ike is really to bring that destiny upon himself as quickly as possible.
I think that's actually a fairly concise reduction of the story that you're telling.
It's very much the story, and not only is it the story, it's a story I reveal at the beginning of the book and repeat and elaborate throughout the book, as myths can be. One of the things I realized when I started this book is that there's no suspense about myths. We all know the endings to them. I thought that there's something kind of wonderful about that because it really confounds such a standard convention of novels, which is reading in order to know what happens. In this book, we know what happens, and I'm constantly, in case you don't get it the first time, you know.
You're making sure we know by the end.
I remind you, yes, ad nauseum, what happens.
Near the beginning of the book, where, as you say, you state much of this, page 5, I wonder if you would read that long paragraph on that page. It ends on the top of page 6.
Okay. These drunken gods had been driven by bus to a place they did not recognize. It's almost as if they'd been on some sort of spring break, as if they'd gone wild. At first, they were like frozen aphids. They were so out of it, as if in a state of suspended animation. It took them several more million years just to come to sort of thaw out. The first god to emerge momentarily from the bus was called El Brazo, the arm, also known as Das Unheimlichste des Unheimlichen, the strangest of the strange. He was bare-chested and wore white Columbia blue polyester dazzle basketball shorts. He would soon be worshipped as the god of virility, the god of urology, the god of pornography, etc. El Brazo leaned out of the bus and struck a contrapposto pose. His head turned away from the torso, an image endlessly reproduced in paintings, sculptures, temple carvings, coins, maritime flags, postage stamps, movie studio logos, souvenir snow globes, takeout coffee cups, playing cards, cigarette packs, condom wrappers, etc. His pomaded hair swept back into a frothy nape of curls like the wake of a speedboat. He reconnoitered the void with an impassive take-it-or-leave-it gaze, then scowled dyspeptically, immediately turned around and returned to the bus, where he suddenly ensconced himself, along with the rest of the gods, for another 1.6 million years. It's extraordinary that among these sulking, hungover deities who chose to forever doze and fidget in a bus, there were several with enough joie de vivre to continue beatboxing that hypnotic riff for an eternity, that music that's been so persistently likened to a dance mix of the Mr. Softy jingle. Perhaps it was a fragment of their alma mater's fight song. They did act, after all, like classmates, as if they'd grown up together in the same small town.
That was very nicely done, thank you. And I think that does give us a very clear idea of at least how one page of the Sugar Frosted Nutsack goes. These gods are, if they only exist in Ike's head, there's a lot of fascinating imagination in his head, isn't there?
Well, yes, I was going to say thank you, but you're praising Ike's head, not mine, which I like even better.
Yeah.
When I originally started toying around with this idea of gods and goddesses, I very much, adamantly, did not want to do anything that was like a parody of Greek gods and goddesses or Norse gods or Hindu gods. I wanted to create a completely unprecedented group of gods and goddesses. So I think that procedure had some pretty interesting results and consequences.
Yeah. Well, we've met El Brazo in the reading that you did. Tell me about, do you say Exo, one of the central gods?
Yes. I have to say, I'm particularly proud of Exo as a character. I would say he may be the surpassing creation of mine over all these years, because XOXO, in a way, represents the nemesis of all writers. I think in the book I originally talk about XOXO as the god of head trauma and concussions and amnesia. But then I distill XOXO's function down to really being the great opponent, the great enemy of the epic. XOXO changes the epic. In a sense, I have to battle XOXO to complete this book. And XOXO is a mischievous god and puts things in the book that I didn't intend to be in the book, takes things out that I wanted in the book. As I was creating this character, I realized it's the most brilliant thing a writer could have, because I can simply blame anything on XOXO. if someone says, I love the book, but I didn't like this part, I'd say, well, of course not. That's an interpolation of XOXOs. I had nothing to do with that. I agree with you.
This may explain why sometimes I felt as though you were writing, I hesitate to say this, but I will, you were writing whatever came into your head.
I've heard that before. If that's what results, it's the most tortured stream of consciousness in the history of streams or consciousness. It's a very meticulous, workmanlike procedure, almost grimly so, to end up with this result. One of the things I wanted this book to have is a kind of subjectivity of its own. It's almost as if the book is the mind creating itself, and you can watch. It's like one of those machines without any membrane over it, so you can see all its inner workings. I think it's very easy to, as you're reading this book, see how the book is almost creating itself from page to page. There's a kind of transparency about it in that way that I like very much.
You've also said somewhere that you think of the world as a cryptogram. Is that true? What do you mean by that, if it's true?
I really love thinking of the world as rampant with sort of signs.
Clues?
Clues and symbols and signs that wait to be interpreted. I think the world exists as a kind of source of exegesis. I was reading some book maybe a year or two ago, and it had to do with, I think, the Sicilian Cosa Nostra. And there was a prosecutor in this case. He said the loveliest thing, which is that it is the vocation of a gentleman to interpret signs. It certainly is my vocation to create a world that is sizzling and pulsing with signs to be interpreted. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad description of what I'm trying to do.
Mark Lehner is the author of The Sugar Frosted Nutsack.
That music that's been so persistently likened to a dance mix of the Mr. Softy jingle.
Here comes Mr. Softy. Yes, everyone comes a-running for Mr. Softy, delicious soft ice cream. That's Mr. Softy.